Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 199, and this podcast is going to be out a little bit later this evening. Had a flight canceled last night, didn't get in until today, and it's just, I was planning on getting this done a lot earlier today because I was coming back in town last night from the holiday, and my flight was canceled again and got in late, so the podcast is going to be out late, but if you don't get a chance to watch it tonight, you'll watch it tomorrow. I hope everyone had a good holiday. I did a quick trip to go and visit some family, and I had a wonderful holiday, and I hope you guys did as well. So the word holiday, what's the etymology of the word holiday? Where does that come from? Holiday. Holiday. Celebrate. Well, the etymology of the word holiday comes from two words. It comes from the word holy and day. Holy day, holiday. That's where the word comes from. The etymology of the word holy day is about the holiday that was just celebrated yesterday. The holiest day in Christendom, in the West, it's been the most important day in the Christian faith for 1700 years at least, in the West, maybe a little bit longer. They didn't start really celebrating Easter in the East until Damasus around the beginning of the 4th century is the one who made it an official holiday. Pope Damasus, he was the Bishop of Rome, coinciding with the rise of Constantine the Great, and that's when it became the most holy day in Christendom. And that's where we get the word holiday. And if you remember what we were talking about in the last podcast, we finished up, we were talking about how, and we're going to listen to more of the Dwight Eisenhower speech in this podcast, but we were talking about how Eisenhower in 1961, when he's giving his farewell address, he's saying that we are a religious people, and we were a much more religious people in 1961 than we are today. But he was saying that we're a religious people, and we're fighting the ruthless atheists, the communist Soviet Union that didn't believe in God. They were not a religious people. They were ruthless, and we were fighting that evil, and we had the moral high ground because we were a religious people. And not only were we a religious people, that we are a religious people that strive for peace and human betterment, because that is what religious people do, strive for peace and human betterment. Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, when he gives the blesseds, he says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they are the children of God." That's central to who, and that's what Eisenhower is saying. There's nothing less than the striving for peace and human betterment is satisfactory for a free and religious people, is what Eisenhower says. I'm paraphrasing, but he says, we're religious people. We're fighting a ruthless bunch of atheists. And then I explained how that's changing now. Now we are turning into more of an atheistic society. we are departing from our religious faith, our traditions, our holidays. Nothing is sacred anymore. And now Russia, they have departed from the communism, and they were under communism for 60, 70 years, and now they have departed from that ideology, and they are turning back to their Christian roots, and they are becoming more religious and a people of faith. And as we are becoming more of an atheistic, humanistic society, and turning away from faith. And I was going through that in the last podcast and explaining that, and that's where we ended up. And we ended watching a speech from Putin where at the end of this, the part that I played, he says that not only are we going to be a people of faith, and we're going to take the scriptures seriously. He says that, you know, that we need to look at the scriptures, that the scriptures say that family is a man and a woman and children. And that's what the scriptures say. Putin says, we're going to hold to that, and we're going to protect children, is what he says. Well, before I went on my trip on Friday, I had to wake up pretty early on Friday. I'm not usually up that early, and if I am, I'm definitely not watching the local news. I don't watch a lot of the local news, but I had the local news on Friday morning before I left for my trip, and this report I'm getting ready to show you came on, and I was blown away by it. This is the local news here in my hometown, and remember the context, everything we're saying, that we're turning away from God, we're becoming more atheistic, more humanistic. Russia, they're turning back to their Christian faith. They said they're going to follow the scriptures. Scripture says there's men, there's women, that a family is a man and a woman, that's the direction Russia is going in. And at the end, Putin says that we are going to protect children. So this was a report that I saw on my local news on Friday morning, before I left for my trip, and I want you to watch this report. Because what is Putin going to protect children from? Who's he going to protect the children from? What's he talking about when he says he's going to protect children? Take a listen.
See, tenure reporter Natay Holmes joins us live from Vista this morning. And Natay, this is the third school employee in the county that we know of that's been accused of having inappropriate relationships with minors. All of those accusations surfacing just within the past week.
In one week, in a 7-day period, three people have been arrested in San Diego, California, for having inappropriate relationships with minors at the schools.
That's right. 21-year-old Omar Galeana is the latest school employee to be arrested. He worked at Deguino Middle School. But this afternoon, he will face the judge inside of this Vista courthouse. He is accused of sexually assaulting a 12-year-old student. The ABC 10 News spoke with parents who say that they were shocked to hear of the news.
I don't know how you prevent it.
I don't know how you prevent it. And I want you to listen to what this parent says.
I don't know how you prevent it. That's exactly the question.
I don't know how you prevent it.
I don't know.
What do you do?
We just want to be able to not have to look into it ourselves.
We just want to be able to. This is a parent. This is somebody's parent. She's saying, I don't know how you prevent it. And we just want to be able to not have to look into it ourselves, is what this woman says. This is the parent.
What do you do? I don't know. We just want to be able to not have to look into it ourselves, honestly, me personally, and know that the school has done, you know, their job. And
no, they haven't done their job, lady. No, the school has not done their job. There's predators at the school. A lot of predators. Three predators at three different schools in 1 week. No, they're not doing their job. How can you say this? What's going on in this country, people?
I know that the school has done, you know, their job and their responsibility to make sure our kids are safe.
No, they haven't.
Now, the San Diego County Sheriff's Office claims that Galeana met a 12-year-old student at Deguino Middle School in Encinitas outside of school hours last Friday. He was arrested 2 days later. Galeana was a campus supervisor at Deguino Middle School for about 3 months. He was in charge of monitoring students on campus and enforcing rules. He now faces multiple felony charges, including child molestation and giving or selling marijuana to a
12 years
minor.
Old.
But as we mentioned, San Diego County has seen more school employees arrested this week. A Mount Carmel school teacher was arrested and is facing 17 charges related to having an inappropriate relationship with a student. And an associate principal at Hoover High School was arrested on child porn charges. Now, the San Diego Union High School District says administrators will be speaking with students in all classes, and they are encouraging parents to do the same.
Wow. So, Putin says he's going to protect kids. That's what he says. Why aren't we protecting kids? Why aren't we protecting kids? Just tell me what. And does this problem, three individuals in this school district, in the same school district in 1 week, arrested for inappropriate contact, inappropriate actions. The one principal had child pornography. And this is not only happening. There's another here. Watch this report. I have this other report. Check this one out.
Please tell me that your child was not a fourth grade student in Tipton County, Tennessee, and that this woman right here, Alyssa McCommon, was not their teacher, because she is now charged with 23 S offenses against minors under the age of 18, and she has 21 potential victims. 21. She's a 38-year-old woman, and she is allegedly pregnant with a 12-year-old student's child. And the saddest part is, do you see in that top corner over there? That is her husband standing inside their house. He was arrested in front of her husband. What in the hell is wrong with people? You heard me. She was a fourth grade teacher. She was arrested last year at the end of 2023. She bonded out in September. She had a no contact order against some of her alleged victims, but she couldn't resist herself. There's now a jailhouse telephone call that has been released at her rearrest hearing, in which she informs a 12-year-old student that they are the father of her unborn child, 12 years old.
Wow. So when was this? What's the date on this? That's March 11th. This March 11th. So that was just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. So this is happening in multiple cities. Putin says he's going to protect kids. Why aren't we protecting kids? This is happening in multiple cities. Who knows? You know, and so this is my question. Does what is happening? Because this stuff wasn't happening when I was in school. This stuff wasn't happening when Dwight Eisenhower was giving his farewell address in 1961. This wasn't happening in schools. Even though the schools were segregated, he was the first to desegregate schools. But even segregated schools, you know, you would go to school and you would they would say a prayer in school before class started. You would say the pledge of allegiance before class started. I mean, they used to have rifle clubs where people would walk around the school with rifles, going to rifle clubs in the school. Nobody got shot. Now the schools are getting shot up. Teachers are having sex with the kids, molesting 12-year-old children. What is going on? So what I want to know is, does this stuff right here have anything to do with it?
If you want to know what it's like to be trans and work with children but not pass as the gender you identify with, let me tell you. I work with preschool age children, about 3 to 4 years old.
And I get Why?
Sent out an email to like the staff and the parents of my room, letting them know that I'm trans and like what pronouns I
use. Why? And
when I'm in different rooms.
Why do preschoolers need to know that she's trans? Please, I don't understand. Why? Why do the preschoolers need to know that you're trans? Please, people, tell me why the preschoolers need to know that she's trans. I don't understand. So what I want to know is do you think that this right here, kids getting molested and people getting arrested for inappropriate preying on children, does this have anything to do with this? This right here. Is there a correlation? Is what I want to know.
Are you a boy or a girl? Because my hair is kind of like a mid-length, but it's short enough that it applies to the kid's logic of like boys have short hair and girls have.
Because when Vladimir Putin says that he's going to protect children, he's talking about this right here. This is what he says that he's going to protect the preschoolers, that they don't need to know that you're trans. You that's what like Putin says.
The parents of my room, letting them know that I'm trans and like what pronouns I identify with and stuff. My coworker is great. She has never misgendered me. And when I'm in different rooms, some of the kids will ask me like, are you a boy or a girl? Because my hair is kind of like a
preschoolers, thing, preschoolers people.
It applies to the kids' logic of like boys have short hair and girls have long hair kind of thing. On my first day in the room, one of the kids asked me how I'm a boy if I have this thing. And then she pointed at like her nose where my piercing is. I've actually had kids correct other kids on my pronouns.
Wow.
He's not a she.
Wow. And if you follow libs of TikTok, I mean, there's so much of this. This is all she does. Here's another teacher. This is what's going on at schools.
Let me introduce you to our non-binary alpaca. The kids voted on a gender neutral name, Alex, for them. Alex was there to help me during the really quiet moments when nobody would talk during virtual learning.
Yes, they were so quiet.
But then I also took it as an opportunity to teach my students about how to respect people's pronouns.
So the other thing too is not only is this I believe very negative socialization going on. The kids are dumb. The kids are dumb. They're not, I mean, the product that the schools are putting out is not, I mean, I can understand if you're doing this stuff, sharing your the fact that you're transgender and your sexuality and all that stuff with kids, and kids were succeeding and they were, you know, the smartest kids, on the planet, and the product that you were putting out was a very productive and functioning and efficient and well-adjusted product when it comes out of that institution. If that was the case, then I would have to look at this and say, well, maybe this is a good thing, but that's not what's happening. It's not what's happening. The product that is coming out of these institutions is a very, very, it's not a good product. It's not a good product. The product that they're putting out are people that don't have any confidence, people that are, that don't know how to work at a job and be a functioning, person in society. Let me see if I can find this. I want to show you what Francis Potter said. See if I can find this real quick. Because it fits right in line with what I'm telling you, people. What is going on? Where is that picture? Oh, man. I must have gotten rid of that. I'll show you guys another time. Well, here, let me see if I can find it right here. This is what Francis Potter says. And I'm not going to get into this really deep in this podcast, because one of these days, and we'll see when we get to it, because I have a lot that I want to share with you guys over the next few weeks. But when we start getting into the education and John Dewey and the Humanist Manifesto, you're going to see that all of this was planned. With the money from Rockefeller, they set out to make our schools dysfunctional and to do this to our society. But Francis Potter, was one of the signers of the first Humanist Manifesto. And this is what he said. Right here. This is what Francis Potter said. He said, "Education is thus a most powerful ally of humanism. And every public school is a school of humanism. What can a theistic Sunday school meeting for an hour once a week and teaching only a fraction of the children do to stem the tide of a five-day program of humanistic teaching?" Charles Francis Potter. That's what he said. And like I said, he signed the first Humanist Manifesto. And one of these days when we go into our education system and what he and John Dewey, who he was friends with, John Dewey also signed the first Humanist Manifesto. I'm going to tell you what these guys did. But I'm asking a question now. Is there a correlation in this?
Yes. But then it opened up some teachable moments about what to do when that would happen. For example, "Hey, Mr. Vung, did he just wake up from his nap?" "Oh, do you mean did they wake up from their nap?" "Yeah, they just did." We would apologize quickly, make the correction, and move on. I started off modeling how to correct somebody, and then afterwards...
He's talking about correcting the kids who called the doll a he, and they should be calling the doll a they. Instead of teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic, and history, and civics... and stuff that they're going to use and they're going to need in their lives. He's teaching the kids how to call the doll they. So what I want to know, is there a correlation between this stuff in the classroom and this stuff going on, this predatory stuff going on in the schools? That's what I want to know. Let's watch one more. Let's watch this one. This is a teacher. She's teaching your kids.
If you had $10,000 to make your school a safer place for LGBTQ+ youth and staff, how would you use it? My name is Miss Ryan, and I've taught both middle and high school, and I've seen firsthand the negative impact of anti-LGBTQ+ and anti-trans.
Yeah, I'm seeing firsthand the negative impact of all of this crap in the classroom. That's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing firsthand the negative impact of all of this crap. That's what I'm seeing.
Safer place for LGBTQ+ youth and staff. How would you use it? My name is Miss Ryan, and I've taught both middle and high school, and I've seen firsthand the negative impact of anti-LGBTQ+ and anti-trans rhetoric and legislation has on our students and on our community as a whole. More importantly than that, though, I've seen the positive impact of bold, brave, unapologetic love.
So Putin says that he's going to protect the children. And I guess that's what he's going to protect the children from. Why aren't we protecting the children is what I want to know. That's what I want to know. So this picture was going around this weekend. And this is a picture of the New York skyline on Easter during Easter weekend in 1956. This is when Eisenhower was president of the United States. Again, Eisenhower says in 1961, when he gives his farewell address, that we are a religious people. We're religious people, and we strive for peace and human betterment. Nothing less would be acceptable for a religious people. And we're fighting against a atheistic people, a people that are ruthless, a people that don't believe in God. We're fighting against that evil. This is 1956. This is on Easter. And they were contrasting this picture. Everyone was sharing it. And they were contrasting this picture with this picture. Now, I think this is the New York skyline being lit up with the rainbow flags. I think that might have been when the Supreme Court, ruled on same-sex marriage and made it legal. But they also, on Easter Sunday, lit up the New York skyline with the colors of the trans flag. The trans flag is different from the LGBT flag. So
take a listen to this. Buildings across New York City lit up in honor of the day. City Hall and One World Trade shine brightly in light blue, pink, and white, the colors of the transgender flag.
Yeah. All right. So we've gone. That's Kansas City. Kansas City, Missouri. They lit up their whole downtown in the trans colors. So we've gone from this in 1956 to this in 2024. This 2024 is 1956. I wonder what they're doing in Russia. I wonder if they lit up St. Petersburg in the trans color, or if they had, you know, a real holy day and honored Jesus on Easter. I wonder what they did, because Putin says he's protecting the kids. Now Joe Biden put out a proclamation on Saturday night. A proclamation on Transgender Day of Visibility. So this Transgender Day of Visibility was created by some trans dude in 2009. So it's been an international day for 2009. I really don't understand it, because look what Biden says here. Expand it. Biden says the Transgender Day of Visibility, on Transgender Day of Visibility, we honor extraordinary courage and contributions of transgender Americans and affirm our nation's commitment to forming a more perfect union. We're all people. Where all people are created equal and treated equally throughout their lives. So, I guess they believe in creation at least. And then it says, I am proud that my administration has stood for justice from the start, working to ensure that the LGBTQI+ community can live openly. Well, I thought that the LGBTQI+ community has an entire month of visibility coming in June. Isn't June LGBT Pride Month? So I really don't understand why there's a trans day of visibility, as well. We have Black History Month in February. We don't have Black Day of Visibility. What is this mess? But for Joe Biden, somebody who's supposed to be a devout Catholic, putting this out, on Easter Sunday, a proclamation. This is a proclamation. That's what it says right there. A proclamation. Everyone was saying, well, this has been on the calendar since 2009. And Joe Biden has always, put out a statement on Transgender Day of Visibility for the past 2 years. This is his third year doing it. But this year it fell on Easter Sunday. And this is a proclamation. Let me show you what he says down here as far as it being a proclamation. Hold on. Where's it at? Right here. Now, therefore, I, Joseph R. Biden Jr., President of the United States, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim March 31st, 2024 as Transgender Day of Visibility. March 31st, 2024 is Easter. That was Easter yesterday. And he's saying that by all the power invested in me or vested in me as president of the United States by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, I do hereby proclaim. Now, yes, it's been on the calendar since 2009, and every year Joe Biden has put out a statement. But you're proclaiming, using your authority, all the authority vested in you, to proclaim as a devout Catholic that this particular day, I'm not talking about all the other years. I'm not talking about last year. I'm not talking about 2009 or 2010 or 2011. I'm not talking about any of those years. I'm talking about this year, 2024, March 31st. This is Easter. You have proclaimed this. Use your authority, all the authority vested in you by the Constitution, to proclaim Transgender Day of Visibility, March 31st, 2024. That's Easter. That's Holy Day. That's Holy Day. So what's going on in this country? What is going on?
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
What's going on? What's going on? Because this is one of, let me see, I think this is, I'm going to show you that in just a moment. But Olivia, oh, look at this. So this was a reporter, Philip Wigman, and he's a White House reporter. He's right there. It says White House reporter for RC Politics. So he's in the gaggle. He's, you know, taking his picture right there in front of the White House. So he was there in the room with the press corps, and he, I don't know if he was the reporter that asked Biden about this or if another reporter asked about it and he just heard it there and tweeted. But this is what he says. I didn't do that. Biden said when asked about proclaiming Easter Sunday Trans Day of Visibility. I didn't do that. What? I didn't do that. Biden said when asked about proclaiming Easter Sunday Trans Day of Visibility. I didn't do that. What are you talking about, Biden? I therefore, as President of the United States, by virtue of the authority of the Constitution, the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim March 31st, 2024 is Trans Day of Visibility. He said, no, I didn't. I didn't do that. Olivia, she's a reporter for Breitbart. And I love this tweet. She says, I'm not Catholic, so I don't know the rules. Can someone enlighten me on how Biden can be part of that religion when he is so clearly and antithetical to Christ? I thought people get excommunicated for less. He's supposed to be a devout Catholic. So not only did he put out the proclamation on the night before, this is day of, on Easter Sunday, March 31st, says right here, that's the day, 12 p.m., high noon, March 31st, exactly 12 p.m. That's interesting. Not 12:01 or anything. 12 p.m., high noon, March 31st, 2024. President Biden, today is Transgender Day of Visibility. I have a simple message to all trans Americans. I see you. You are made in God's image, and you're worthy of respect and dignity. Well, you're definitely worthy of respect and dignity. I don't doubt that. You are made in God's image. Where's that? Where have I heard that before? Where does that come from? You are made in God's image. Okay. Yeah, that comes from the Bible. That comes from the first chapter of Genesis. It's right here, the 27th verse of Genesis. It says, so God created mankind in his own image, and in the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. That's where you got this, Joe Biden? They're made in the image of God? You took that from the Bible? And it says God created them male and female. And now they're saying God made a mistake, that they're in the wrong body. Wow. Oh, this guy's Catholic. This guy's Catholic. Hey, what's going on here? This guy's Christian? Because you don't seem like that. I mean, this doesn't seem very Christian to me. This seems exactly like what Vladimir Putin was talking about and what I was playing in the last podcast. That's what it sounds like. So it sounds like this is the Joe Biden's director of education. He runs the Department of Education. Listen
to him. Department of Education, we know that all students do their best when they're seen and they're supported.
They do their best when they're seen and they're supported. This guy's the director of education, that students do their best when they're seen. No, students do their best when they have good teachers and they study and they have the resources they need to learn. When they're seen, where'd this come from? What does it have to do with students learning? But this is the problem. So this guy's the director of education. No wonder you got this stuff going on in the schools. And again, it's not by accident. It's not by accident that all of this is going on. Back to Francis Potter, Charles Francis Potter. But it's no wonder that this is going on in the schools. It's no wonder, because this guy didn't even know. I mean, no, it's no wonder that the product that you're putting out, the education, the product that is coming out, that these kids are dumb. It's no wonder, because you're focusing on the wrong thing.
Students do their best when they're seen and they're supported. To the many transgender students across the country listening on this Trans Day of Visibility, we in the Biden-Harris administration want you to know that we see you, we support you, and we celebrate you.
What is that we see you part, that we see you? Isn't the idea that they're supposed to blend in? I mean, what? Why are we supposed to see them and they're supposed to be unique? I mean, or they're not supposed to be unique and stand out. They're supposed to. I mean, none of this stuff makes sense. None of this stuff makes sense. None of this stuff makes sense. So you had this happen. So nothing's sacred anymore. You had this happening. Also on Easter Sunday, a Easter Mass that was disrupted by pro-Palestinian supporters protesting the war in Israel. I don't know why they didn't go to a synagogue on Saturday and why they're disrupting a Christian. Are they going to go to a mosque on Ramadan? Of course not. Are they going to go to any? Why are they disrupting a Christian service on Easter Sunday? Look at this. I mean, so nothing's sacred anymore in this country. You think that Putin would? What would happen to these people in Russia? What would happen to these people in Russia if they disturbed a Easter service on Easter Sunday with their anti-war demonstration? What would happen to these people? Man. So nothing sacred anymore. Nothing sacred. So back to Eisenhower. Eisenhower. So if you don't know, he was a general in the military, and he commanded the armies that stormed Normandy in World War II. After the war, he ran for president and became president of the United States. He served two terms as president, and his administration ended in 1960. In the election in 1960, his vice president, who was Richard Milhouse Nixon, ran against John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And it was one of the closest races in American history. But Kennedy inched out and won that election. And Kennedy was going to be sworn in 3 days after Eisenhower is given this speech in 1961, in January of 1961. Let's revisit the clip that we played last week, and then I have more of this speech that I want to play.
We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. Three of these involved our own country.
So the four major wars, I do believe he's talking about the Russian Revolution, one, and then the three that involved us, World War One, World War Two, and the Korean War. So that's what I think he's referring to. I'm not entirely correct.
Among great nations, three of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment.
How we use our, it's not only what makes us great, that we have, at this point in the 1960s, that the United States was the most powerful, the most influential country on the earth. And what Eisenhower is saying is that we should approach that this moment of power with humility and to strive for peace and human betterment. He says it several times.
In the interest of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among peoples and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance or our lack of comprehension or readiness to sacrifice would inflict upon us grievous hurt, both at home and abroad. Progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world. It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty the stake. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment.
So the goal is peace and human betterment, because we're a religious people. That's what Eisenhower is saying, that is our moral cause, is peace and human betterment. It goes to the heart of who we were as a religious people in 1961, is what Eisenhower was saying. All right? This picture, again, was just 4 years. This 56. So 5 years before Eisenhower is giving that speech. So this is the America that he was talking about, that we strive for, that this America, religious people, strive for peace and human betterment. All right. So let's listen to this part.
A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. we have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
So that's one of the most well-known parts of this speech, is where he warns about the military-industrial complex and says in the councils of government that we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted power by the military-industrial complex. That as a religious people, we strive for peace and human betterment. And the thing, and this, he's giving a stark warning. This is the first time in American history and world history that we have had a ongoing permanent armaments industry. And he says that you have to understand the dangers of that, because the military-industrial complex is about making money. And what the military-industrial complex makes money on is selling weapons. And you can't sell weapons unless you have war. Nobody's selling weapons in peacetime, is what Eisenhower's talking about here. So the military-industrial complex, if they're allowed to seize the councils of government, they can push us towards war so they can sell more weapons. It's A to B. So they can sell more weapons. So he says that he's giving a stark warning here. He's leaving. He's leaving in 3 days. He's been in office for 8 years. Now, something about this speech you got to understand. That I don't know if Eisenhower didn't know this or if he's being coy in this speech, but in his administration, the councils of government had already been taken control by the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex had already taken control of the councils of government in his administration, and they had been since the beginning of his administration in 1953, beginning with the coup in Iran in 1953 when his CIA overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh. This was his Secretary of State, Dwight Eisenhower, John Foster Dulles. And John Foster Dulles's brother, Allen Dulles, was the director of the CIA under Dwight Eisenhower. And these two guys, John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles, worked for this law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, while they were in the Eisenhower administration. What I'm telling you is that these guys, John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles, these guys, Allen Dulles, the director of CIA, and his brother, the Secretary of State, that while they were working as director of Central Intelligence and Secretary of State, they were working for this law firm right here, Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell is an American multinational law firm headquartered in New York City. It is one of the most profitable law firms in the world with 2001 profits per partner exceeding $6 million per partner. These guys were running foreign policy, John Foster Dulles, and his brother, Alan Dulles. They were running coup d'etats in other countries for private organizations, for Dole Fruit Company. It used to be called, what's the fruit company? Oh, right here, United Fruit. It's called Dole Fruit Company now, but it was called United Fruit. So United Fruit Company would hire Sullivan and Cromwell, and then Alan Dulles and his brother, or John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, were going and staging coup d'etats in places like Colombia and other places for their clients, United Fruit Company and other clients that would hire Sullivan and Cromwell. So what I'm telling you is that Dwight Eisenhower, the councils of government had already been seized by the military-industrial complex. I'm sorry that you didn't know that. Sorry you didn't know that. This guy, too. I want you to know about this guy, Averill Harriman, because Averill Harriman, he ran this firm also in New York at the same time as Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles were running foreign policy for private business out of New York. Brown Brother Harriman is the oldest and one of the largest private investment banks in the United States. In 1931, the merger of Brown Co. and Harriman Brothers Co. formed the Brown Brothers Harriman. And who worked for this firm? Who's this guy? Prescott Bush. Prescott Bush worked for Brown Brothers Harriman. These guys were doing business with the Nazis and ended up having, they had their funds seized for a period of time after World War II because they were doing business with the Nazis. So at the same time that Prescott Bush was the senator of Connecticut, and look at when he was senator of Connecticut. He was in office from 1952 to 1963. This is when Prescott Bush, at the same time that Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles were working under the Eisenhower administration, Prescott Bush, senator from Connecticut, was working for Brown Brothers Harriman in that same decade. And they were all working on foreign policy and issues for these private businesses, for these private firms, for these law firms. They were working for the big business in New York while they were working for the Eisenhower administration. So I don't know if you didn't know that, Eisenhower, that the councils of government had already been taken over by the military-industrial complex in your administration. In your administration. Listen to what this says right here about Averill Harriman. Well, I'll introduce you more to Averill Harriman in another podcast, because I want to tell you a lot about him. These are the guys that killed Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. These guys. Alan Dulles sat on the Warren Commission. Averill Harriman was the mastermind. They planned it. They're the ones who killed John F. Kennedy. So Eisenhower gives this speech just 3 days before Kennedy is sworn in. Listen to what he says again. Now you have that context that the councils of government had already been taken over in his administration. So listen to him again.
Resources and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Well, I wish you were guarding against it in your administration, because these guys were running rampant in your administration. On Friday night, Fareed Zakaria was on the Bill Maher show, and they do that overtime bit after the show. And one of the questions was asked to Fareed Zakaria about oil-rich nations in the overtime. I want you to listen to what he says. It's crazy. But I just want to give you some context about how the military-industrial complex had already taken over the Eisenhower administration.
Or Fareed, why do you say that oil-rich countries have a hard time modernizing?
Well, it's sort of like, think of trust fund kids not working hard. Basically, if you don't need to go through the hard work of modernizing your economy, educating your population, putting in the right infrastructure, if all you have to do is dig a hole, get oil, sell it to America and Europe, it's the easy way out. And it's one of the reasons why you've seen in almost every oil-rich country, Nigeria, Venezuela, Iran.
Kuwait.
Iran. Now, when he said this, I was listening to him, and I was like, I've never liked Fareed Zakaria. I don't think he's smart at all. But when he says this, Iran, what are you talking about? Iran is not in chaos right now because they have oil. Iran is in chaos right now because these guys stole their oil. They staged a coup in 1953. Iran was a democratic country where they would elect their prime minister by democratic elections. They weren't a theocracy. The mullahs were not in charge in 1953, but Mohammad Mossadegh was about to nationalize their oil and British Petroleum, and the West didn't want. Mohammad Mossadegh to nationalize the oil in Iran for the people. So these guys, Alan Dulles and MI6, they staged a coup in Iran. Fareed, they staged a coup. The CIA staged a coup in Iran. That's why Iran is a theocracy. And the way that it is right now, because the CIA staged a coup and installed the puppet Shah. That's what happened. Listen to this guy again.
And it's one of the reasons why you've seen in almost every oil-rich country, Nigeria, Venezuela, Iran.
Kuwait.
There's a dysfunction, there's corruption.
Yeah, there's dysfunction in Iran because of these guys. These guys, they had already seized control. The military-industrial complex had already seized control, and big business had already seized control of the government. So it was already too late when Eisenhower was giving this warning. I don't know if he knew that or not, but after Kennedy is sworn in January of 1961, the very first thing that happens is the Bay of Pigs incident. I want to show you this. I told you I'm going to tell you more about Averell Harriman later. But one thing that I will share with you about Averell Harriman right now that I think is important, and look at all these positions that he has. Now, his father was one of the railroad barons. Here's his father right here. Harriman was born wealthy family of the son of a railroad baron, E.H. Harriman. So his father was he owned the railroads. You know how when you play Monopoly, you have the railroads, you have Park Avenue, you have the electric company that represents Edison. The railroads, one of the railroads is E.H. Harriman. So that's Averell Harriman's father. And he was ambassador. Look right here. United States ambassador to the Soviet Union, Averell Harriman, from October 1943 to 1946. So right after World War II, or at the end of World War II, he became the ambassador. I guess Truman or FDR makes him ambassador to the Soviet Union. So he was over in Russia. And when I tell you more about it, I'm going to let you know what this guy was doing over there. But they did not want, that's why I believe that they killed Kennedy. And people have all kinds of theories, but I think that the biggest reason is because Kennedy was, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy had started talking to Khrushchev, and he wanted to make peace with Russia, and they didn't want peace because you don't make no money in peace. I'm going to play a little bit of this clip about the Bay of Pigs. I don't have very much time. We'll play a little bit of this, and I want to pick this up in the next podcast. I know I said that we would get into Mesopotamian history. I think that can wait until Monday. I have some more of this stuff that I want to share with you guys on Friday. But take a listen to this clip about the Bay of Pigs. This happens immediately after Kennedy is sworn in.
1961, as Kennedy stepped into the presidency, he was briefed on the festering situation with Cuba and the plan he would be inheriting. Several months earlier, the CIA under Eisenhower had created a plan to overthrow the Castro regime.
It wasn't about Cuba in and of itself. It was about the fate of that region, a region that we did not want to lose to the communists.
Starting in March 1960, the CIA had begun to train Cuban exiles to conduct an invasion. These exiles would ideally put up a fight that would inspire the Cuban people to rise and help topple Castro in a coup d'etat.
So they're running another coup d'etat. They start the administration doing coup d'etats in Iran. They do a coup d'etat in Guatemala. They do coup d'etats, you know, in many other places. Just coup d'etats. So they were doing that all through the Eisenhower administration, running this foreign policy, I guess, behind Eisenhower's back. I mean, he acts like he didn't know what was going on, but that's what these guys were doing. So Kennedy comes in, and Dulles and his boys already have the Bay of Pigs plan. That's why they said that he inherited this plan. So as soon as he comes in, they have the Bay of Pigs planned.
Leadership with the Democratic government. Kennedy was unsure about authorizing the complex invasion. He was worried if it became public that the Soviets would see the American intervention in Cuba, their ally, as an official act of war.
The CIA was telling him that Castro was about to get a large shipment of arms from the Soviet Union, including MiG fighter jets. And once Castro got these, it would be almost impossible to get rid of him. So it was kind of now or never. He felt compelled to go forward with it, knew it was a bad idea, but he did not know how to undo it.
On April 16th, Kennedy reluctantly agreed to the plan with one major exception. If the operation foundered for the Cuban exiles, the U.S. military would not intervene.
All right, well, I can tell I'm not going to be able to show you guys all of this. So we're going to, when we get back on Friday, we're going to pick up right here talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, about the Bay of Pigs. And then we will go into the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I'm going to have a bunch that I still wanted to tell you. I thought that I would get to it today, but I had to share the stuff about, you know, about what happened this weekend with Easter and Transgender Day of Visibility, and just, I mean, all of the craziness going on in our country and how far we have turned. I'm going to hash this out a little bit more on Friday, and then I'll see you guys then. I hope you guys have a great week, and thank you so much for listening.